This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What most of us know about drug marketing comes in the form of catchy ads, the ones where fresh-faced couples frolic on meadows and mountain trails while announcers advise us to ask our doctors about the wonders of Paxil or Cialis. But there's also a lot of marketing we don't see, where drug companies try to influence what doctors say about drugs when we ask. Pharmaceutical companies are responsible for much of the information that doctors get about new drugs. Sales departments provide everything from informational literature to continuing education. And with billions of dollars in prescriptions at stake, their tactics have become increasingly direct and controversial. The New York Times reported over the weekend that one pharmaceutical company is accused of sending $10,000 checks to doctors in return for a promise to prescribe their drugs. While that may be an extreme example, more and more drug companies face multi-million dollar settlements for getting on the wrong side of the law as they try to sell their products. Later in the program, we'll talk about an age-old medical device that could certainly use an image makeover, the lowly leech. But now, the tactics, techniques, and troubles of marketing pharmaceuticals to doctors. Where's the line between information and bribery? If you're a doctor or if you work in the pharmaceutical industry, call us with the inside view. And if you're a patient, do you talk with your doctor about how he or she decides which drug to prescribe? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone is New York Times science reporter Gardner Harris. He wrote this weekend's story, and he's at the offices of the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Neil.
Your article opens with that rather shocking tale of doctors getting $10,000 checks directly, and it sounds like out of the blue from a drug company.
It was out of the blue, and it was a surprise to the physicians I talked to.
From what you've seen covering this topic, how far beyond the pale is that kind of tactic?
I think it's on the aggressive end. Having said that, you know, this is not just happening in the United States. Police in Venice, Italy, announced last month that they were investigating 4,400 doctors there for taking payoffs, essentially, from GlaxoSmithKline to prescribe their drugs. Perhaps as a result, GlaxoSmithKline is the leader in the Italian market. So, you know, paying doctors thousands of dollars in cash is certainly unusual and probably somewhat rare. But as physicians will tell you, and as probably some of your later guests will talk about, drug companies spend a lot of money trying to persuade physicians that their drugs are the right drugs. And they give away still quite a few freebies. And what crosses the line into sort of ethically murky territory is a little unclear.
Well, give us a quick overview of some of the more common techniques.
Well, anybody who goes to sort of a large group practice, ask your physician what he ate for breakfast and who provided it to him. Ask your physician what he ate for lunch. In many of these large practices, drug company sales reps come in every day on a rotating basis and provide, you know, bagels and fruit for breakfast and, you know, Balducci's sandwiches and salads for lunch. And that is a relatively common phenomenon that many doctors are somewhat uncomfortable with, but their whole staff ends up eating. So they sort of put up with the practice in many ways. A lot of physicians go on pretty nice vacations. Now, there's a new pharma marketing code that has cut back on the sort of the most egregious violations, which was for a long time stuff called dine and dash, where physicians would simply show up at the nicest restaurant in town, have to listen to a sales pitch for about 3 minutes while their food was prepared, and then they could leave with a very nice dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And some physicians that I've talked to managed to eat just about every night on a drug company.
We'll be talking with a representative from pharma about that new voluntary code and some other things a little bit later in the program. But as you mentioned, 15 years ago, we were worrying about junkets, doctors taking ski vacations on the drug company's dime. Have things changed?
Not just 15 years ago. I mean, that code was only adopted about 2 to 3 years ago. Things have changed somewhat, although you know, the junkets still happen. Sometimes now these junkets are sponsored not directly by a drug company, but by, say, a hospital that gets a grant from a drug company, and then the hospital itself sponsors a seminar in a very nice place and brings physicians that they think would benefit, and that it just so happens sometimes the drug company also thinks would benefit by discussing a particular drug. So there's a lot of money sloshing around among physicians from the pharmaceutical industry, and there has been a lot of worry, certainly now, about what is appropriate and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's any doubt that all these practices have ended, and investigations into many of these practices are continuing apace at U.S. Attorney's offices in Philadelphia, in Boston, and in Washington.
Now, how many of the major companies are in legal trouble for marketing tactics like the ones you're describing?
I can't think of offhand any single company that is not in legal trouble. Just about all of them have been subpoenaed as part of these investigations.
That suggests that the competition for market share is very intense, and everybody has to keep up with the Joneses or the Glaxos, I guess, in this case.
Exactly. I mean, look, this is a $400 billion business. Just a small inch up in market share brings in enormous profits. And, you know, because these drugs are all patented medicines with limited patent life, the companies are under intense pressure to take advantage of their patents for, you know, the brief period that they have them. So they push very hard to beat out their competitors for those years that they're on the market, because they all know that at some point a very cheap generic is going to come along, snatch away their discovery and their idea, and start selling their pill for, you know, 10 cents, 20 cents a pill instead of the $3 and $4 that many pills cost.
Now, there is another tactic that you describe in the article, these clinical trials of medicines that have already been approved. Again, describe that for us.
Well, this is probably the I hate to use the word most egregious, but certainly the most difficult for many of these companies to explain, because, you know, the one thing that the drug industry has going for it is its research, and everybody agrees that research is a great thing, and many people agree that they don't mind spending that much money on medicine if they feel that their money is going toward research. And when they mean research, they mean good research. But Shearing Plough was using its research really as a marketing tactic. They were paying physicians $1,000 to $1,500 for every patient they put on their very expensive hepatitis C medicine, and saying that this was all part of a clinical trial. Now, the patients paid for the medicine themselves, or their insurance paid, and Shearing Plough was not all that diligent about collecting data from these physicians. At the end of the day, these trials were not all that scientifically rigorous, and many cases led to little or nothing except sales for the company.
Well, joining us now to talk about how the medical community addresses the issue of drug marketing is Dr. Catherine DeAngelis, editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, as it's better known. She's with us from their headquarters in Chicago. And Dr. DeAngelis, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Nice to be with you.
Drug company marketing seems to be a perennial issue for conflict of interest to pieces. Is this something the medical community is concerned about?
Oh, very much so. In many ways. Where do you want me to start?
Well, let's start with policing. Aren't there ethics codes that would prevent doctors from many of these practices?
Well, yeah, there are ethics and codes. I mean, the American Medical Association has a policy that physicians should not accept gifts from anyone that are over $100. But the issue is who can enforce this? I mean, the Hippocratic Oath is something that you take, but you enforce it yourself. And so the same thing goes for physicians. Now the problem is that I think if you were to take the 700,000 or so practicing physicians in the United States, the vast majority of them adhere to that and self-police. But there are people who have a different ethic or who see it a different way. And so I think the same thing happens with the pharmaceutical companies. My own personal belief about the pharmaceutical companies and how we get into this problem is that there is not separation of the scientific part of the pharmaceutical companies from the marketing part. Now, if you look at the scientific part of pharmaceutical companies, by and large, the scientists who perform the basic science studies and the people within the companies themselves who perform the studies are by and large among the best and brightest in the United States. There's no, or perhaps in the world. That's not the issue. The issue is that the marketing part gets mixed up with the scientific part. And that's where I think we run into trouble.
Is there any data on how these marketing practices affect doctors' prescribing habits?
Well, you've just been discussing some of it. Now, data? I mean, there are a number of articles about, you know, why would a pharmaceutical, let's begin with the very basics. Why would a pharmaceutical company pay to take a physician out to a ball game or golfing, or invite them to come and learn about something at a continuing medical education conference at some nice place? Why would they do that if they didn't think it affected practice?
And Neil, there's a sort of an insidious part of this that few people know about, and that is that there are companies that track very closely precisely what drugs physicians prescribe. So drug companies know in absolute, you know, bottom line numbers, what if, I don't know if Dr. DeAngelis is still practicing, but if she was, they would know exactly the drugs that she is prescribing.
Oh, sure.
So yeah. So when these doctors see these sales reps, they know that the sales reps know exactly what drug they're prescribing. So it's a very uncomfortable situation for many physicians. Many physicians like their sales rep, and many physicians feel a little beholden, which is the point, of course, when a sales rep takes them to the baseball game.
Well, let's get a listener involved in the conversation. Troy joins us from Wausau, Wisconsin.
Wausau, Wisconsin.
Okay, Wausau.
I guess I've heard a lot of these talks about pharmaceutical companies, and I'm a pharmaceutical rep myself, and I hear a lot of the bad things about pharmaceutical companies and reps, and I certainly don't look at the industry or my job through rose-colored glasses, but I think that what's always left out is the role that the doctors and the staff and the nurses play in some of the money that companies have to spend in order to get doctors' times. In many cases, in offices that I go to see, I cannot see a doctor. I can't even look at doctors, or much less speak to them, unless I'm buying the entire office a lunch. And from our perspective, you know, I think if you talk to most pharmaceutical reps at most companies, we would rather not have to be spending the money and going through all the pain of picking up a lunch and bringing it, just in order to talk to a doctor. In a lot of cases, the information that we're giving doctors is very valuable, and it's information that they need in order to treat their patients in the best ways.
So lunch is a kind of an entry fee.
Yeah. Well,
in a lot of ways. And
we'll get to you, Dr. DeAngelis, in just a second.
Okay.
Okay. Look, we're running out of time in this segment. Troy, can you stay on the line with us? And
sure.
We'll get a response from Dr. DeAngelis when we come back. Can you stay on the line with us, doctor?
Yes.
Okay. Hang on, and we'll be back after a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how drug makers market their products to doctors and what that means for patients, insurers, and the medical community. Our guest is Gardner Harris, New York Times science reporter. Also with us on the line is Dr. Catherine DeAngelis, editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And just before the break, we were talking with Troy, a drug company representative in Wausau, Wisconsin. And he was talking about, well, Dr. DeAngelis, I guess he was essentially saying that doctors now, or at least some doctors, there's almost extortion of the drug company representatives sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, I with all due respect to Troy, I agree with him that, yes, you say you almost have to do that by lunch or whatever. My question is, why does a pharmaceutical company have to pay a drug representative to teach a doctor how best to take care of his or her patient? That is the role of continuing medical education, which should be done by other physicians who have more expertise in the area. And while I certainly don't want to deprive Troy of his trade and what he's trying to do, there is a role for that. But I say let's stop thinking that we're giving continuing medical education to physicians from drug representatives. Let the physicians get it where they should, and that is from other physicians who have more expertise in a particular area, and let Troy get on with other aspects of his business. And I think that I think it's terrible that Troy or anyone else thinks that he or she has to provide lunch, donuts, pizza, or whatever to physicians to get their attention.
Troy, I take it those decisions are made probably above your pay grade.
They are, but, you know, if I can respond to what the doctor said about educating physicians, my personal training, I have a degree in human biology. It was a pre-professional degree. I could go to medical school if I chose to. And I spent a total of about 7 weeks in training learning about the drugs that I represent. And in many cases, I know as much, if not more, than most of the physicians that I speak to. And as far as, you know, doctors being educated by other doctors of people that have more experience or more knowledgeable, in a lot of cases, I completely agree. But doctors these days are extremely busy with managed care, and the opportunity for pharmaceutical companies to give information to doctors at their own offices by taking 5-10 minutes of their time to talk about, you know, their medication mm-hmm. and their competitors' medications and showing them studies and discussing these things, it is very valuable to doctors and in many cases teaches them things that helps them care for their patients better.
Okay.
The truth, though, Troy, is what you teach them about is your drug, because that's what you know better. Then you said you know more than in many cases physicians do your drug, which is fine. What I say is physicians should be learning about your drug and all other types of drugs and other therapies from other physicians,
Troy,
not from drug representatives.
Troy, thanks very much.
Hey, Troy, call me anytime. This is Gardner Harris.
New York Times phone number, I think you can find it in the phone book.
That's right.
Okay.
Troy, thanks very much for the phone call.
All right, bye-bye.
And Dr. DeAngelis, so we appreciate your time today as well.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Dr. Catherine DeAngelis, editor-in-chief of JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. She was with us today from their headquarters in Chicago. Well, joining us now from his office here in Washington is Scott Lassman, Assistant General Counsel for PhRMA, the industry group representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
As we heard earlier in the program, most of the major pharmaceutical companies are facing some kind of legal action in this regard. While your organization is barred, as I understand it, from commenting on the specifics of any of those cases, what does it say that there are so many of these cases right now?
Well, I think what you're seeing now is maybe a historical effect. First, let me say I agree with Troy that there's nothing wrong with marketing. It can provide valuable information to patients, but it should be done correctly. In 2002, our organization adopted what's called the the pharmacode on interactions with healthcare professionals.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like called the pharmacode to try and lay out the boundaries of what acceptable marketing practices are.
These are voluntary guidelines.
These are voluntary guidelines. They were adopted in 2002, and the basic principle is that the physician's decision about what medicine to prescribe ought to be based on that physician's knowledge and the best interests of the patient, not on a physician's relationship or perceived relationship with a pharmaceutical company.
Well, does the number of cases that we're hearing about, does that suggest that maybe voluntary guidelines aren't strong enough?
No, I don't think it does. The code actually it was adopted by all of the CEOs of our companies, and it has been very effective. It is working. I think what you see today is a very different environment than what existed before. And I think if you look at the cases which are coming down the pike today, those, for the most part, are based on activities that were occurring in the late 90s, certainly well before the pharma code was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you do have the same environment today post the pharma code as we might have had a couple of years ago.
So these cases are catching up with egregious practices of the past.
Yeah, I mean, Scott is absolutely right, Neil. I mean, most of these cases rely on you know, whistleblowers who are talking about late 90s, early 2000, 2001 stuff. But, you know, what is sort of at issue here is, Neil, you and I are journalists. You and I have ethics codes where we basically don't take money from anybody. We don't take really meals from anybody because I think there's a general sense that if we took such remuneration, it might color our stories. Now, I guess I just don't basically understand why physicians think it's okay for them to take money, because when it's physicians doing it, we're not just talking about newspaper stories, which, you know, as we all know, mostly line bird cages the next day. We're talking about prescriptions that are vital to people's health. And I don't think patients really want to worry about the idea that they're getting this prescription because should they wonder whether they're getting this prescription because some doctor got a sort of a nice meal, mm-hmm. or because he likes a sales rep, rather than if that drug is the right drug for that patient.
Scott Lastman, shouldn't a medicine sell itself? I mean, why do you need these aggressive tactics?
Well, just picking up on that last point, I would hope that there aren't any physicians out there that would prescribe a medication just because they got a nice meal from a sales rep or a nice pen or something like that. And I don't think that happens. I'd be shocked if it did, and I certainly would not want to go to a physician that would be swayed like that. But what we try and do in the pharma code is lay out what are the parameters, the acceptable parameters of what how the interactions can take place. And certainly giving money to physicians is clearly prohibited by the guidelines unless the physician is serving as in a capacity as a bona fide consultant. And there are all kinds of ways that the pharmaceutical companies have a legitimate need for physicians to act as consultants. But we do understand that there is the risk that, you know, some of these relationships can be used to, you know, try and provide kind of backdoor payments to physicians. So we try and very clearly lay out and define what would constitute a bona fide consulting arrangement and say that that's okay while strictly prohibiting the type of consulting arrangements that I think were discussed before and have been discussed in some of the recent cases.
Let's get another listener on the line. Jeff is with us from Worcester, Massachusetts.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I wanted to comment. I work in a residency training program where we train both medical students and medical residents. And we've taken special care to try and isolate somewhat our learners from the drug representatives because we found them to have a particularly strong influence on our medical learners. I think their gifts, their dinners, their trinkets go much further and establish patterns of behavior that stick with people through their training and into their practice.
With medical students?
Yes.
So people who aren't even allowed to prescribe anything yet.
Exactly. They start very early. They're glad to talk to medical students and residents and bring lunch to events where students and residents will be gathering.
Scott?
Neil, if you talk to a medical resident, they will often tell you that the only way they get a meal in these terrible hours that they have is mm-hmm. from drug reps.
Actually, our residency program provides lunch tickets for people when they're on call, both for lunch and for dinner. So there's an allotment for food for every day. Certainly what they can get from the drug representatives is tastier than what we have in the hospital.
And I suspect that if they could provide a four-hour nap, that would really build some loyalty.
That would go over a lot further.
Scott Lastman, why do drug representatives market to medical students?
Well, again, as I said, marketing has an educational component to it, and really our code tries to stress that should be the primary purpose of marketing. So to the extent that these residents will be graduating go out in the world and prescribing the variety of drugs, it only makes sense to try and educate them about the proper use.
But, Neil, I mean, what the Pfizer case of last month, the Neurontin case, showed is that you have to worry a little bit about what some of these folks are educating physicians about. In the Neurontin case, sales representatives were telling physicians that they should prescribe Neurontin in many diseases that they knew Neurontin did not work for. To this day, 90% of the use of that drug, Neurontin, which is a $2.7 billion seller, 90% of its use is not in the approved indication that Neurontin is supposed to work in. It's in a whole variety of other diseases that even the company's own tests show it didn't work in. Nonetheless, the sales representatives were telling physicians, well, you should try it in this, you should try it in that.
That is something that is strictly prohibited by FDA. Companies are not allowed to market off-label, and if in fact that's what was going on, it would not be consistent with our views or with FDA's requirements. That being said, there are a lot of drugs which are used extensively off-label. Cancer in particular is one of those diseases where there's an awful lot of off-label use. It's something which fits well within the practice of medicine. Pharmaceutical companies, as I said, are prohibited from providing information on those uses, but again, it is an accepted piece of the practice of medicine, for particular disease states, happens quite commonly.
May I add one additional comment?
Go ahead, Jeff.
I just I think it's a little bit deceptive to talk about an educational role, because just as Dr. DeAngelis said, what these representatives do is educate about the use of their drug in particular, occasionally mentioning its indications, but really not giving a comprehensive picture about when it's appropriate to use one medication over another, or educating about the use of a class of drugs or the treatment of a particular condition. So I just don't think that really represents what's truly going on.
Sounds like your medical students are getting younger and younger, Jeff.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
Hey, Jeff, call me anytime.
Bye-bye.
we're filling out Gardner-Harris's phone book, if nothing else.
Yes.
We're discussing the marketing of drugs to doctors. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's hear now from Jason, who's with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, I just had a comment about something that might help patients better understand their doctor's relationships with drug manufacturers and representatives. It may be interesting to have some sort of disclosure box on new prescriptions written that would state the level of integration a particular doctor may have with a drug manufacturer.
Scott,
I wanted to try and get a comment on that. You know, just
Scott Lastman, might that be possible?
I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing the question.
Jason, could you repeat it, please?
Sure. I was wondering if it might be possible to have, when a new prescription is written for a patient for a particular drug, to have some sort of disclosure on that script that would give the patient an idea of their doctor's relationship with the manufacturer of the drug that's being prescribed to them.
A disclosure of some sort to Scott Lastman?
I mean, it's hard for me to speculate. I imagine it'd be possible. It'd be, you know, I think fairly difficult to apply in practice. But, you know, certainly if a patient has concerns about any relationships his or her doctor may have, you know, they ought to ask.
We're told that a lot, that we ought to ask our doctors about all kinds of things, yet that's often a very vulnerable moment. Patients are in the doctor's office and concerned perhaps about more immediate concerns than the doctor's relationship with the drug company.
Yeah, well again, relationship may be a misnomer. And again, if companies are complying with the pharma code, and my sense is that at least most, if not all, of our members are, the types of things you'd be talking about are meals, giving of pens and notepads with the logo of a drug on it. Again, I don't think that these are the types of things that would worry most people, and we certainly have made the decision that this is the appropriate place to make the cutoff, and doctors are not going to be swayed in their clinical judgment based on getting a pizza or a set of pens from a drug rep.
Jason, thanks very much for the phone call.
Sure, thank you.
And we just have a minute or so left with you, Scott Lastman, and I really wanted to go back to Gardner Harris's question. Given, again, a pizza shouldn't sway a doctor's opinion, but no, it smells bad. It looks bad. It makes people, it's the perception of a conflict of interest. Isn't there a way to just cut it out?
Well, again, I guess we may have differing views on that. To me, it doesn't smell bad, and it doesn't seem to be it shouldn't be a problem. A lot of this is just social discourse. My wife has always taught me, when you get invited to someone's house, you bring a bottle of wine. It's that kind of thing. It's not the type of thing that's gonna sway somebody. Cash payments. Yes, obviously that would be a problem, and that's something that's prohibited by the pharma code. Giving lavish vacations, taking somebody out to a ball game, we think that that's inappropriate. But bringing a pizza by, again, I don't think that that's something that people should be worried about. Again, if a doctor has a problem with it, no one's forcing the doctor to accept these types of things, and they can certainly turn them down if they believe that there's a problem with appearances. But
Scott Lastman, thank you very much for being with us today. We thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Scott Lastman is Assistant General Counsel for Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. He joined us from Washington, D.C. And Gardner Harris, thank you for your time today as well.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Gardner Harris is science reporter with the New York Times. He was with us from New York City, the Attorney General of Connecticut, after a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about the gray areas and how pharmaceutical companies market drugs to doctors. And joining us now is Richard Blumenthal, Attorney General for the state of Connecticut. His office has pursued several high-profile cases against the drug industry. He joins us now from his office in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
When did enforcing regulation on pharmaceutical companies become the concern of state attorneys general? Isn't this the FDA's problem?
Hardly, because any deceptive or misleading practice that affects consumers, patients, citizens is an issue of concern to attorneys general, regardless of the product. Obviously, the FDA has authority or jurisdiction over whether the drug is safe and effective. But as to pricing and marketing practices, certainly the states, as well as the federal government, have a vital role to play. You know, we are actually major purchasers. The states are major purchasers of pharmaceutical products. So we have a direct stake in pharmaceutical drug pricing, and that is the reason, I should say parenthetically, that many states have advocated, as I have advocated, better purchasing practices to make use of our power in the marketplace.
So what kind of practices has your office pursued?
a variety of practices throughout this industry that affect the prices of pharmaceutical drugs. Just a few examples: the marketing practices that involve rebates, other practices that may be in effect disguised kickbacks by the pharmacy benefit managers, so-called PBMs,
mm-hmm.
that involve purchases of drugs by these PBMs sold to the ultimate consumers or through them, through other individuals or groups through to consumers, and then payments to those PBMs by the manufacturers. We have made a matter of lawsuit in our action against Medco. We've also sued a number of the pharmaceutical companies themselves because, in effect, they have disguised or concealed the actual prices through their manipulation of a process called the average wholesale price, which is what they say to the state they will be charging under the Medicaid or Medicare plans. A highly technical area, but it's really huge consequences, mm-hmm. has huge consequences to the states through the kinds of prices that are disguised or misled. And then finally, practices such as were described, I think, earlier in your show about the payments to doctors, disguised payments, gifts, incentives, which we have complained of, and we have taken legal action in some instances. We've actually filed a citizen's petition with the Food and Drug Administration against the manufacturer of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, because we say that some of the off-label prescriptions are the result of past marketing practices by the company. And the company has changed many of its marketing practices. But
and some of these companies have paid a multi-million, you know, what look on paper to be huge settlements on the same hand, though. A lot of people say, look, given the profits they're making from these drugs, even big settlements are just a slap on the wrist.
And what we've seen is only the tip of the iceberg. To be very blunt, our investigations are continuing very actively and aggressively as multi-state groups. We're not relying on one state alone. We're working together with other states. And I think every state has a stake in this issue because all of our consumers are vitally concerned and affected. And these settlements may involve hundreds of millions of dollars, but again, if you look at the huge amounts of profits at stake to the companies on single drugs, the payments to the doctors, even if they're $1,000 or more, and the payments in the settlements may be regarded as simply the cost of doing business. So I think there is a real role for criminal action here, and the U.S. Attorney's offices in various parts of the country are taking an active role.
Richard Blumenthal, thanks very much. I know you're very busy. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Richard Blumenthal is Attorney General for the state of Connecticut. He joined us today from his office in Hartford, Connecticut.